versus Bay Health. Are you ready to proceed?
Good morning, Mr. Romano.
May it please the court, this case involves really what I think is a simple issue of whether the lower court erred in not submitting the issue of outrageous conduct or reckless, grossly negligent, or intentional tort to the jury. And the factual basis that we contend that gives support to our contention that the facts were there for a jury to decide whether there was outrageous conduct were three facts. But maybe just a little bit of background. This, of course, is a case where Mrs. Sharon Good had several miscarriages, had another miscarriage. I think it was her sixth or seventh miscarriage on in April, and I think it was April 24th. And then when she was in the hospital, she was so upset that she didn't even want to see the baby. But then she was going to have him pre-made, then decided not to do that, and decided to have an autopsy to see, I guess, why this occurred. And so she told him to have an autopsy and that she was going to bury the baby and not to cremate it. And then she went home. And 16 days later, when no one had called her about, and she knew the autopsy had been done because she had gone to her doctor and the doctor had read the autopsy report to her. So she called the hospital and said, you know, where's my baby? My baby's body, of course. And the person that she talked to that was identified as Mrs. Wiley was the Secretary of Social Services there, told her that the baby was, and apparently in an apologetic way, told her that the baby was in the morgue as being unidentified and unclaimed. The fact that the hospital allowed this baby to be in this morgue for 16 days and identified as unclaimed, frankly, in itself, I think, is reckless conduct. But if you really look at the consequences of what that meant was that Mrs. Good, who did not really want to even see the baby after the baby was born and was very upset about it, of course, had to go and identify this body that was 16 days in the freezer or refrigerator, I guess. Of course, it was only 22 weeks, so it was in itself not well formed. And, of course, it had been autopsied. Frankly, I'm not sure this was actually even argued by the attorney that tried this case, but in my knowledge, that's not only cruel, that's bizarre. Because this person, I mean, how this person is going to identify a baby that she's never seen as her own is bizarre. But that is a fact. She was required to go in that morgue and identify that body in order for them to release the body to the funeral director. Now, that is not disputed. I mean, Mrs. Wiley apparently, well, at least that's a testimony of my client, but it is not disputed that Mrs. Wiley said, it's not disputed that this body was sitting there as identified as unclaimed. Mrs. Wiley testified that way. And all of the various paperwork support that. And the fact that you have to go in there and identify the body before it can be released was testified to by the funeral director, but also at least by my client who told Mrs. Wiley that, you know, why am I going down there to the morgue? He said, because you have to identify the body in order for us to release it. So if my client's believed, she is required to go to this morgue and identify a body that has been there for 16 days, she's never seen before, has been autopsied, and is, of course, not very well formed.
Mr. Romano, let's assume everything you just said is true. And doesn't the record also reflect that when she got to the hospital, she never did go inside to identify the body?
She did go inside, but she came back out again. She went inside, they started to unwrap the body, and she's like, I can't do it, I can't do it, and ran back out again. And then her friend said, well, I'll do it. I'll identify the body. Obviously, her friend could identify the body, of course, but I guess it was a formality to say, this is it, which, frankly, is ridiculous. But that's the third part of our claim, that there's facts that for a jury to decide that it could, that it was outrageous. And that is the fact that Mrs. Wiley or supervisor, the person who showed the body to her, Donna Winchester, was nothing but a guard, of course. I shouldn't say nothing but a guard, but I mean, this is not her job. She, none of these people were aware of the procedure. There was an effect for showing bodies to people in these situations, these circumstances. And except that Donna Winchester initially, her deposition said that she didn't know about the procedure. In the trial, she actually said that she did know about the procedure, but decided to ignore it, not to follow it in showing this, because the procedure, of course, the policy that they had would have done, you know, would not have allowed just a guard saying here, unwrapping and say here is the body. There was much, much more to it to try and lessen the impact.
Mr. Romano, yes. The jury verdict in this case included an express finding that negligent conduct of the defendant was not the proximate cause of your client's injury. Is that right?
That is correct. Correct. Except that, Your Honor, you want to finish the question or should I continue?
Well, what I wanted to follow up on that is if proximate cause has been decided against your client, aren't all of these other arguments academic?
Not at all, Your Honor, because when you have negligent infliction of emotional distress, you need bodily injury. And the jury was instructed that they could not find in favor of the plaintiff without bodily harm or compensable damage and if it was only transitory bodily harm, they could not find either. They have to find something that constitutes physical injury. And Mr. Turner, in a very well argued in his summation, very well argued that issue by basically saying to the jury, I mean, repeating this, they had to find physical harm or bodily injury, and then said, you know, I would say, Mr. Satterfield, what is your physical injury? He used the word Mr. Satterfield, but of course he was saying plaintiff. And that's what the jury barely found, no physical injury. But if you have outrageous conduct, you don't need physical injury. All you need is severe emotional distress. That's what the pattern instruction says. That's what the law says. That's what the cases hold.
Well, now, do you have, and can you refresh my memory as to the specific interrogatory that the jury answered? Was it, do you find that the negligence of the defendant was a proximate cause of injury, or did it say physical?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I did not try the case, and I'm not sure that the actual jury question is in here. Mr. Turner may be able to help us, but I'm not sure, Your Honor. But in any event, I mean, they were told that they had to find physical injury. I'm not sure what the question itself said, but they were told that was it. So, but when we're dealing with outrageous conduct, we don't need a physical injury. Physical injury is obviously something that is hard for a jury to see when you're talking about someone that's emotional distress. And especially when you're saying, you know, you need physical injury. Where is this physical injury? But if the jury had been instructed, all you need is severe emotional distress. The jury had been instructed, however, if you find intentional or outrageous conduct, then all you need is severe emotional distress. That's a totally different ballgame. I mean, the results, the consequences are less than negligent for outrageous conduct. So it is like night and day, black and white. I mean, totally different. So you have the jury that has these facts before them, these facts that I just discussed, that could have easily found that there was outrageous conduct, but they were never allowed to do so because they were never instructed that way. The instruction that was requested on intentional affliction or emotional distress was denied by the court, and not because the law was wrong, but simply because the court found there was no evidence that would allow a jury to find this gross negligence, reckless conduct, outrageous conduct. The court said, if at best, we have negligent.
Let me go back to some of the facts here. Am I correct that at the last minute, as you indicated, your client said, you know, she couldn't handle looking at the body, right?
That's correct.
So she either left the room or didn't enter the room, but one way or another, she was standing outside of a room that had Venetian blinds or something like that, and that the only, I don't mean to put this in a negative light, but that the reason why she suffered what she suffered, whatever it was because after having said, I don't want to look at the baby, and the hospital people saying, that's fine, you don't have to, she then voluntarily looked through the blinds and saw the body? Is that what the facts are?
Well, I mean, the facts are that she was outside, the facts are there were blinds, but the facts also were there was an opening, was not completely, the door, the window was not completely closed, so you could see through it. Whether she, you know, peeked, so to speak, intentionally, or whether she was just standing there and couldn't avoid seeing it, really wasn't developed, I don't believe very well. The fact of the matter, however, is that the guard knows that she's out there, and I assume knows that she's able to see, and they're still insisting that this person, who was never seen the baby anyway, quote, identified this corpse.
Right, but I'm trying to get to the next step in this process, because I understand that she was there because she was told she had to identify the body.
Right.
But if the facts are undisputed that at the final point at which somebody had to do that deed, she declined. The hospital said, you don't have to. Your friend can make the identification. She stayed outside of the room, but somehow she saw the body, even though she didn't have to be looking that way. She didn't have to look through whatever the gap was in the blinds or you know, whatever it was that allowed her some visual contact in terms of seeing the body. Isn't that the basis for the jury's having decided that there was no proximate cause?
We don't know, of course, why the jury decided. My own belief is that the basis for the jury finding that is because they did not find a physical injury. Because that's really what was stressed by Mr. Turner. And I can't tell you for sure because I said I didn't try the case, but and Mr. Turner can comment on this, but I don't believe the argument was, well, she intentionally looked. I think the argument simply was, where's the physical injury? But even frankly, if the argument was she didn't have to look, that still does not take it away from the jury. This issue of outrageous conduct from the jury, and we can't really guess why the jury found against her. All we're looking at, or all I guess that we're here for in this court as the function this court has, is to determine whether the lower court erred in not submitting this to the jury.
Well, but what I'm trying to parse out here is, let's assume for the moment, for purposes of having this dialogue, that the trial court did make a mistake and should have given an instruction on outrageous conduct. Would it matter if the jury has determined that whatever the hospital did was not the proximate cause of whatever the harm was?
It would not matter if we were absolutely sure that the jury said, we find outrageous conduct, but we find that it's her own fault because she looked when she didn't have to look. But we don't have that. I mean, we have no way of knowing the jury did. So,
well, if they find there's no proximate cause, isn't that what they're saying?
No, they found no injury. They found that she sustained no injury, and no injury could be no physical injury. It's the problem. I mean, we don't really know what they found, because all we have is them answering a question, and I think the question is that, you know, do you find negligent? They said yes. Do you find any injury, I suspect. Again, I apologize, but I just don't know what that is.
All right.
Well, Mr. Romero, you mentioned that several times you didn't try the case. And what the court would like you to do within 5 days of this argument is send the court, through the clerk's office, and opposing counsel, the actual interrogatories that were submitted to the jury.
Very well, Your Honor. Very well. The other issue that we're also appealing is the issue of not allowing the doctor to testify about psychiatric impropriety, that the hospital acted improperly in not allowing in what they did. And that was not allowed by the court because the court saw it as standard of care, and which really was not the standard of care because this is not a malpractice case, a negligence case.
I'm sorry, yeah. Mr. Romero, can you be a little more precise about what the court precluded your medical expert from testifying about?
The court, let me find that very quickly. The court ruled that the
there's a quote at page 30 of your
yes.
Around 29 of your opening brief.
Yeah, yes. 29. It's 40. I'll have it in a second, Your Honor. Here it is. The question was asked, Doctor, do you have an opinion from your review of the material and your interview with Mrs. Good as to whether, from a psychiatric standpoint, that the hospital acted appropriately in permitting the viewing in the manner that they did? Mr. Turner objects because he says that he was not identified as a standard of care expert. And the court said that the question could be asked as to what he found and so forth. He said, so you can ask the question as to what is expressed in that opinion, but not in terms of did Kent General act appropriately. So he was not allowed to say that Kent County did not act appropriately. And that was in his report that Mr. Turner had for 11 months. But he didn't use the terms standard of care, and that's the basis of the understanding of not being allowed. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Turner.
May it please the court. I may be able to save Mr. Romero some trouble. The jury interrogatories actually are in the record at A375, and the questions that the jury was asked to answer and their answers were as follows, and I'll just read what appears on the page I've cited. Madam Forelady, has the jury agreed upon a verdict? Poor person, yes, we have. Do you find that the defendant was negligent? Answer, yes, Your Honor. Do you find that the defendant's negligence was the proximate cause of injury to Sharonda Good? Answer, no, Your Honor. So those are the questions that the jury answered. And I would like to attempt to argue a little more articulately than I did when this was argued before why that should be the end of the court's inquiry on the issue that plaintiff has raised on appeal. This incident occurred on May 11, 2001. The plaintiff testified that she saw something through the Venetian blinds that caused her enormous emotional distress and has caused it to continue for the 5+ years that elapsed when the case came to trial. And it was apparent to the jury and the judge that Ms. Good had some issues, emotional issues, because if one parses the transcript, you will realize that there were numerous instances during the trial when she became hysterical had to be asked by the court to leave the courtroom, could be heard wailing in the hallway. She clearly had problems, and the jury also heard that she had multiple stressors in her life that would go along with the kind of behavior she demonstrated this time, the seven miscarriages that she'd had before this, being raped when she was a teenager, having another stillbirth after this, giving birth to a 23-year-old child that is so severely damaged that it will never leave a hospital. This individual clearly had a lot of things that would cause her to be upset. But the issue the jury had to decide was whether whatever happened, whichever version of the events the jury chose to accept occurred on May 11, 2001, was responsible for this. And while the plaintiff claimed that she'd had this distress continuously ever since May 11, 2001, and claimed rather vaguely to have seen doctors about it, there's nothing in the medical records that documents this complaint of post-traumatic stress syndrome until April 30, 2003. And I made this argument before the three-judge court, and Mr. Amuno claimed it was wrong, so I've written down the citation where in the record that fact appears, and it appears in the testimony of Christina Eilers, who was the social worker who had worked with the plaintiff during 2003, and that testimony appears at Defendant's Appendix, pages B22 through 24. Now, the plaintiff did continue to see her treating physician. That is,
what will we see on B22-24?
You will see that the plaintiff first presented for treatment to the place where Ms. Eilers worked, which is called the Center for Human Development, on April 30, 2003, and that her treatment there continued through March 2004, and that she was complaining of post-traumatic stress syndrome related to this episode 2 years earlier. Now, the plaintiff claimed that she had been treated for this by her treating physician, Dr. Nazreen Khan, who did not testify at trial, but whose records were put in evidence by the plaintiff. And I have included those records in the defendant's appendix at pages B11 through 14. And it documents treatment after the stillbirth, but before the supposed traumatic event, and it documents treatment after the supposed traumatic event. And all one will see are the rather expected entries relating to incisional pain and need to take oral contraceptives. And there is no reference in any of these entries, which, as I recall, extend through August 2002, to this alleged post-traumatic stress syndrome. Now, the jury heard from a forensic psychiatrist who was hired to examine the plaintiff in July 2005 that she had post-traumatic stress syndrome, and the plaintiffs claimed that there was a physical component to this injury. And we were not litigating this case on that issue and didn't litigate it and offered no psychiatrist in rebuttal. But Dr. Kay, the psychiatrist who offered this testimony, testified that in his opinion, as a result of the post-traumatic stress syndrome, the plaintiff had an autonomic response that was a physical injury that she had that was permanent. And that appears at pages 211 through 213 of the plaintiff's appendix. So the plaintiff attempted to present evidence of a non-physical injury that had a physical component to it. Now, this injury, as it were, was the very reason that the Debernard versus Reed decision was issued by this court back in 1971, that juries need to be told about what a subjective symptom is as opposed to what an objective symptom is that a doctor can appreciate apart from what someone tells them. In this case, everything was premised on what Ms. Good told Dr. Kay in July 2005 when her lawyer sent her for this examination. And there's no dispute about that, and he offered the opinion that she had post-traumatic stress syndrome with physical injuries associated with it based on the history she gave him. But the jury was free to accept or reject the plaintiff's complaints. And there were a lot of things that the jury knew to be true that were contrary to what she had told Dr. K. So when the jury learned that the first documented treatment for this supposed injury was on April 30th, 2003, and that this lawsuit was initiated the very next day, the jury might understand that there was more to this than meets the eye, and that whatever was wrong with this individual wasn't something that was caused by this event that occurred in a hallway on May 11, 2001 at Kent General Hospital.
Let me ask you in terms of the argument relating to intentional infliction of emotional distress and outrageous conduct, reckless conduct, and so on. If that instruction had been given, how does the argument that you're now, that you're going through in terms of proximate cause and so on, how does that relate
well,
to that?
My argument is that the jury finding that any negligence of Kent General Hospital did not cause any injury to Ms. Good forecloses that argument, because the plaintiffs presented evidence of physical injury, and the jury either rejected it and concluded that it wasn't true, or rejected that it didn't that it had anything to do with the events that were at issue that had occurred exactly 2 years before any medical record of it.
So now there's some argument in the appellant's papers that if you had outrageous conduct or intentional infliction of emotional distress, that something less has to be proved as what in terms of injury, and maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but what's your understanding of the law as you think it should be applied here?
Your understanding is correct. A negligent infliction of emotional distress must be accompanied by some physical component. An intentional infliction of emotional distress does not. But the plaintiffs chose to present evidence of physical injury in this case, and I've given you the citation for that. And having done so, and the jury having found no causation, my position is that that finding forecloses this entire argument, because they presented the injury claim. The jury had a basis upon which it could either find it, one, not true, or two, not connected to the event complained of, or both.
You and Mr. Romano are a little bit like ships passing in the night, because he's suggesting, and the problem was requiring him to prove an injury, and that's what led to the verdict. And you seem to be arguing they did, in fact, prove an injury, and they even had the benefit of a lesser standard, in that if the jury didn't find negligence caused the injury, if they had been instructed as he requested, they wouldn't have found that the outrageous conduct caused the injury either.
Well, if I could restate that a little. I mean, the plaintiffs, before any ruling by Judge Young, chose to present the evidence that they chose to present. And they chose to have Dr. K articulate that this injury had a physical component to it. And that's their choice. But having done it, and the jury having found no proximate cause of any injury, they can't now argue, well, if there'd been a different standard, they'd have found an injury. That it just doesn't work, because they presented both non-physical injury and physical injury, and the jury found no causation of any injury. And having found that, my position is that ends the inquiry. But I'm prepared to address the intentional infliction issue.
Is that because they're, as a result of the jury finding, they're collaterally estopped? That is, even if there were error on the part of Judge Young in not instructing the jury on the issue of outrageous conduct, it wouldn't matter. Because
correct.
The jury found no emotional distress.
Well, the jury found no injury.
And no injury, which you are arguing would include emotional distress, correct?
It includes both emotional distress and physical injury, both of which the plaintiffs presented, and the jury was simply asked, is there an injury that was caused by the defendant's negligence? The answer is no. And that ends the inquiry. I don't know that I'd call it collateral estoppel.
Direct estoppel.
Yeah. I mean, they had a chance to present their case. They presented it. They presented both physical and non-physical injuries. The jury found no injury caused by the defendants. and therefore to send the defendants back for trial again on a supposed intentional infliction of emotional distress issue would be to relitigate something that's already, in my view, been established. But I would like to.
Let me just follow up with a couple of points here. With respect to the question that you read to us from page A375, that the jury was asked, did defendant's negligence or was the negligence the proximate cause of injury to Good, and the answer was no. Am I correct in assuming that there was no further questioning of the jury? In other words,
correct.
Okay. So what we're stuck with, if I understand correctly, is that the jury could have been answering, no, defendant's negligence was not the proximate cause of anything. Or they could have been finding defendant's negligence was not the proximate cause of physical injury. Because hadn't they been instructed prior to deliberations that in order to find liability, you have to find that there was physical injury?
They were so instructed.
So when they answer a question that says defendant's negligence the proximate cause of injury, they could have inserted physical into their thinking in reaching the answer no. And well, then we're stuck with, what if the instruction had been given on outrageous conduct, in which case arguably they could have found, there wasn't physical injury, but there was emotional injury.
Well, on this record, I don't think so, Your Honor. I know that's the plaintiff's argument. But the plaintiffs chose to present the emotional injury with a physical component all bound up in one and agreed to the jury interrogatory, which was just read, that says, in effect, any injury. And by finding no, the jury is implicitly finding no physical injury. Either the physical injury doesn't exist, they don't believe what Dr. Kay said based on the fact that they don't believe the information provided him by the plaintiff was accurate, or they don't believe it has anything to do with the events complained of, or both.
Well, you've confused me when you say the plaintiff chose to do this. Are you saying this is the decision the plaintiffs made prior to the ruling that the outrageous conduct instruction would not be given?
Correct. The testimony about physical injury was presented on the third day of trial. The ruling about outrageous conduct occurred on the fourth day of trial.
Were the words any injury in the question that was asked to the jury, or just injury?
The precise question was, quote, do you find that the defendant's negligence was the proximate cause of injury to Sharonda Good?
Injury.
Can you help me with the prayer conference? Was this a proposal from plaintiff as to these interrogatories? Or Paul?
That's a good question, Your Honor. And the one thing I can remember about this trial was that it was tried in courtroom number 2 in 95-degree weather. And so my memories are a little bit hazy about some parts of it, but I don't want to speculate. I really don't remember. I mean, I don't remember there being a great deal of dispute about the jury interrogatories, nor do I remember the plaintiff submitting an alternative to the two questions that were asked.
Well, did both the plaintiff and the defense submit proposed jury instructions that included interrogatories?
Again, I'm not sure. I honestly can't remember whether the jury interrogatories were formulated by Judge Young. I do not have that folder with me. I could look and answer that question if the court feels it's important.
Was there a court reporter there for the entire prayer conference?
For at least a good bit of it, yes.
But not all of it.
I'm sorry. This was a very taxing trial, and I just honestly don't remember.
Well, Mr. Turner, you've been really helpful with regard to the questions, and you saved Mr. Romuno some work. But it would be helpful to the court if you can see what you can do on reconstructing the prayer conference and the origin of the proposed questions.
By next Monday?
Yeah. The end of next week is fine.
Well, I'll
10 days would be fine.
Could you address, apart from the causation, the issue of outrageous conduct?
Sure. To analyze whether there's any outrageous conduct, the court has to go down one of two paths. Either the conduct was outrageous on the part of one of the two or both of the two employees who were involved in this showing, and it must be analyzed in conjunction with the allegations made by the plaintiffs at trial and the testimony that was offered in support of it. And Mr. Ramuno argued that allowing a body to remain in the morgue for 16 days was itself reckless conduct. Well, that wasn't the issue that was litigated. The issue that was litigated was allowing the mother to see the child. And that's what was the supposed alleged negligence and recklessness, because there's this hospital policy which is geared to a different situation, but which the jury heard about and which the plaintiff's expert said the hospital was negligent because it didn't follow the policy and these two employees didn't follow the policy. If one analyzes the conduct of the two employees, that is Willie and Winchester, neither of them knew how long this child or this fetus had been in the morgue. Neither of them knew that it had had an autopsy, and neither of them knew anything about the situation other than that the mother had appeared asking to see her child at Kent General Hospital, which they knew has a policy, which nobody criticized, of encouraging mothers of stillborns to see and bond with their stillborn before the stillborn is either buried or cremated. And so somehow from that state of knowledge, and Mr. Ramuno argued again today something he argued the last time that I requested the opportunity to submit a citation on, and that is whether this guard consciously disregarded a policy with which she was familiar or whether she just was ignorant of it. And I submitted the pages, which were, I believe, A201 to 203 from the plaintiff's appendix, in which it's clear that this security guard wasn't familiar with this policy. And as Judge Young said, well, that may be inartful, but it's certainly not atrocious or outrageous. And the policy itself, all it says in any event is that there must be determination whether the viewing should take place, and these individuals who knew nothing about the circumstances of the death, when it was, or that there was an autopsy, were doing so in the context of a hospital that encourages mothers, at least, to see a stillborn and attempt to bond with it to get closure. And nobody has said that's a wrong thing to do.
Wasn't it, I thought that somewhere around May 10th, so 15 days after the stillbirth, that the plaintiff had called the social services department and asked about the baby, and I thought someone at the hospital indicated that she thought it was unclaimed or unidentified or something like that.
That's what the plaintiff claimed, and we're not clear who she talked to, and it's possible somebody would have told her it hadn't been claimed because it hadn't been. I mean, that was the truth. I mean, it's the mother's or the family's responsibility to have the funeral home come pick it up. And she claimed that she went to the funeral home, Mr. Torbert, and Torbert told her that she had to go to the hospital and identify the body. Well, Torbert testified that that simply wasn't true. And so the two employees who were dealing with her thought that she was there to see her baby before it was buried. And they did what they did, and that can be negligence, but I would submit it can't be atrocious or outrageous conduct in the context of these facts. The other path, and one that the plaintiff didn't attempt to prove, is that they could have attempted to prove that, and Mr. Ramuno attempted to argue it this morning, that there was institutional outrageousness or recklessness, but that would require some specific proof from the experts as to why it was outrageous or why it was reckless as opposed to negligent. And the record is devoid of any such evidence. There is no evidence by any of the experts that there was any reckless, malicious, or outrageous conduct in an institutional sense.
Well, was the testimony of Dr. K that was excluded, would that have gone to that point?
The testimony of Dr. K that was excluded was that the hospital was negligent in not following the policy and then allowing the mother to see the baby. And after Judge Young excluded it, the plaintiff slipped it in anyhow. And the citation for that is A215 in the plaintiff's appendix. So besides not being identified in accordance with the case scheduling order, besides being cumulative to the testimony of Dr. Ross, their standard of care expert, it came in anyhow. And so I submit that is not a
the jury's finding was consistent with his opinion.
Correct. Sure, it made no difference. I mean, they found that. Absent further questions, I...
Thank you. Mr. Romano, so we're clear, we don't need the interrogatories, but Mr. Turner is going to get us the prayer conference and proposed instructions by each side by Friday, May 11th, and the court would like you to look at your records and do the same thing.
I will, Your Honor.
So both sides can submit those simultaneously.
I will, Your Honor, but actually the jury instruction conference, the transcript of that, I'm not sure if it's complete, is Exhibit 1 of the appellant's brief. And in it, at the in it, the court will note that the appellant's, Mrs. Good's trial attorney, Ms. Peterson, did request that the pattern instruction 1401 be given. And if 1401 had been given, the instruction would have read, if you find the defendant's conduct was outrageous and extreme and that this conduct caused the plaintiff to suffer severe emotional distress, then you must find a defendant liable for damages. So that's the point that I'm making, is that we would not need a physical injury. But getting back to the instruction, of course, this was rejected by the court.
On that point, though, in terms of the interrogatory, if the plaintiff showed that there was an accompaniment of bodily injury, the damages could be awarded not just for the bodily injury, but also for any emotional or psychological injury, correct?
No, you had to file. You mean if this instruction had been given?
No. In terms of the negligent infliction of emotional distress, if the jury had found bodily injury, the damages would have covered not only the bodily injury, but also the emotional injury.
Oh, yeah, yes. Once they found, they could not award anything unless they found bodily injury. That's what they were instructed to do. That was the instruction. And Mr. Turner, I don't mean to read his summation, but just so you understand, he goes on to say that you need this physical injury. He says, because the legal concept requires under Delaware law that before anybody can recover money for emotional distress, they have to satisfy you that it is accompanied by a physical injury. Then he goes on to say that, and I think the reason for this requirement may be somewhat self-evident, that being that anybody can say anything about anybody, and that person at the other end could claim to be offended by it and claim to be emotionally distressed by it, but how do you prove it? I could call Mr. Satterfield there, and no good, you know what, and he could come into court and say, you said something about me that offended me, I'm emotionally distressed, and I'm entitled to money. And I would say, well, Mr. Satterfield, what is your physical injury? Well, when we're dealing with this, with the hypothetical situation that I talked about a week ago, a car accident, somebody breaching their duty, and then he goes on to talk about physical injury. So, I mean, this was the gist of the entire case. You've got to prove physical injury. And the court instructed them that way. The court said you have to have physical injury. And frankly, not only...
And what did the court instruct on damages? The damages were physical injury and emotional injury.
It says that the defendant's conduct is negligent as creating an unreasonable risk of causing emotional disturbance to another, and it results in emotional disturbance alone without bodily harm or compensable damage or only transitory bodily harm. the defendant is not liable for such emotional disturbance. If you find, however, that the emotional disturbance is accompanied by long, continued mental disturbance, which you find constitutes physical injury, then the defendant will be liable for such emotional disturbance as you determine is the proximate result as previously defined of this incident. So they're basically told they've got to find a physical injury to award anything. And when the question is asked, do you find an injury? I mean, they have to look at the, what they've been instructed, physical injury. They say no, no injury, meaning no physical injury. The injury that we're talking about is a you know, term of art. I mean, they were told physical injury. Now, they didn't, the voir dire, the voir dire question does not use the word physical. In fact, if you look at the instructions, it was asked by Mr. Turner that the word physical be inserted. But Ms. Peterson said no, because they're going to be instructed as to what injury means, basically, and the court said, okay, I'm going to leave the verdict form the way it is. I can't tell whether you prepare it or not, and we'll comply, of course, with Your Honor's request, but that's the way it came about. Now, frankly, I'm somewhat perplexed by Mr. Turner saying, well, you chose to put in physical injury. All that the person said was, and he had to say this, otherwise it would have been thrown out of court. If our expert had not said, she suffered such a long-term medical condition that, in my opinion, it constituted physical injury. If he had not said that, we would have been dismissed. I mean, we would not have been able to get the jury, because having found it was not outrageous, or he was not going to allow it to go to the jury on outrageous, having found that you need a physical injury for negligent, then obviously, if without that testimony, it would have been dismissed. So the fact that the expert said what happened can constitute physical injury doesn't mean we chose to do that. I mean, we had to do that. The only way that the plaintiff could get there. I find this perplexing. I mean, it wasn't a choice. That was our case. You had to have it in order to proceed with this case.
Well, but Mr. Turner's saying that you presented your evidence before the ruling on the instructions, and your case included an emotional component and a physical component, and the fact that you did that allowed you to go to the jury on negligence, even though you might not have gone to the jury at all if you'd only had an emotional component. But that all of those decisions on presenting emotional injury and physical injury were made during the course of trial, you know, before the prayer conference.
Well, the complaint in the entire case was two counts. One was negligent and one was intentional. So we were trying to prove both, and of course the court ruled against us on one. But I mean, it wasn't a decision we said we're going to, you know, not pursue that. So
I'm great. Thank you very much. The court appreciates both of your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.